it is my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker, my friend Roland. He has the same amount of sobriety as me and the same birthday.
Good here? Good. I'm Roland. I'm an alcoholic. Oh, man. When I first came in, I didn't understand anything, and I've got 377 days, and I can tell you without a shadow of a doubt, I still don't understand so many things. But one of the phrases that I read and heard in the meetings is, you can't give what you don't have. And my journey is just about that. It's about you can't give what you don't have, but you can give what you do, and control drinking, the amount and the level that I try to control my drinking. The people I am going to mention, specifically my mother and father and some other people, I love them very, very much. And one of the passages in the big book was about on awakening, that we divorce ourselves from self-pity. Self-pity, I love self-pity. I love to think about how I was wronged and who wronged me and what I'm going to do to get back. But what really self-pity means to me in the context of my own story is that alcoholism ran in my family, but alcoholism was a part of me. It was as if it was skin that I wore all the time, and there was no separation between what I did and what alcoholism is. There was no separation between telling a lie and telling the truth. It just all blurred together. And so the habits that I formed were based on an alcoholic mind. I didn't know that. But worse than an alcoholic mind was a dead heart. It was just dead. And I didn't know it. I didn't know it was dead. I could smile, I could laugh, I could thought I was having a good time, but I wasn't. What I was doing was I was feeding to my incomprehensible stuff that happened, but what was happening around me was alcoholism. What was happening inside of me was something I couldn't control and I was powerless over, and I thought I was. So my head and my heart were completely out of line, and for such a long time I just thought that's how you live. I was born here, and I was raised here, and I went away for a little bit for college, and boy, that was a good time. But so what I'm talking about is the things, you can't give what you don't have, but you can give what you do. And so the things that I'm talking about, it's not about status. It really isn't. It's not about, gosh, this person did this, and wow, look at them, and all this. What it was my parents giving me what they had, and they gave me all that they had. So it wasn't about the education or anything like that. It's how it fed my alcoholism that I didn't know anything about. My father was born in the Hawaiian Islands, and he was born in the Hawaiian Islands when it was still an island in 1925. My father, I don't think, was loved very much. But, you know, you can't give what you don't have. What my grandparents were very involved with was getting an education. So they moved from the island, I think, of Kauai and went to the main island. And my father commenced to go to a private school that our last president went to. It was called Punahou. And Punahou, I guess, was a very big school. I remember one time Dad showed me a picture of this pool that he was going to help raise some money for or contribute to. And I go, Jesus, Dad, why would you want a pool in the middle of the ocean? I mean, it's an island, for God's sakes. And he didn't think that was very nice, but I always was coming up with comments like that that kind of just threw him. But one of the things culturally that happens in the Hawaiian Islands is, since it was an Asian culture, they numbered their sons or their people from the oldest to the youngest. And what that meant was that the oldest, in my mind, that the oldest was somehow blessed. So he would introduce us as my eldest brother, Rolf, who's 4 years older than me. He'd go, this is son number one, son number two, and guess I am son number three. Three's an odd number. I never liked that number. If you turn it on its side, I guess you can make the letter M. But I never liked that. So I was always introduced as son number three. Now, I just never, and I said, what about Lila, my twin sister? Well, she's in a different category, so God. So being introduced right there at that moment at a very early age when he was counting a number on us, I was the last number, I felt terrible. Now, it wasn't any particular action that he did. It's just the words that he used and the tone that he used it in. A complete misrepresentation of what he meant. My mom was born in Nova Scotia. Oh, by the way, my father left the islands when World War II happened. Then he went to finished out high school. Then he went to a college called Stanford, at which he got undergraduate and an MBA from Stanford. And my God, was I lectured on getting a license to do business with. I hate Stanford. I hate Stanford. I hate Stanford. They were the Indians, Cardinals, I don't care what you call them. I didn't like it because I could never in a million years meet that kind of standard. Stanford is the place where captains of industry were born. Well, George Washington didn't go to Stanford. Alexander Graham Bell, and my favorite person, this guy that, you know, Anheuser-Busch, he did not go to Stanford. I said, Dad, Anheuser-Busch did not go to Stanford, and he's got like freaking dogs and big horses that got this great beer cart. I mean, please, Stanford's not the end all. But he just made it. But this is what he was given, and this is what he gave to me. He was dead set on getting me an education. My other brothers did fine. They were, you know, valedictorian, summa cum laude, all these kind of great. The camping trips were not camping trips. They were lecture tours. We had camping themes of going to where, you know, all the battlegrounds, all the colleges, lecture after lecture. I remember sitting down, and this was just a normal thing that we did. He would put us in around the dinner table and read articles to us, and then we're supposed to take notes. Always taking notes. I don't know what we did with the notes. I know what I did with mine. But, you know, you'd have these filing cabinets full of information. And I said after one particular thing, I think it was on Truman's gold standard and something like that. And I said, Dad, I don't understand what you just read. And he said, well, that's not a question. I go, great. How do you understand what you just read? I was totally mystified in that situation. Totally and completely mystified. My other brothers seemed to be okay, but you know, they're whatever, you know. Shit. I hated every second of it. So one time, how I got relief. Well, this is what happened. My father had arranged some sort of lecture series up there at the Sequoia about trees and, you know, the great sequoias and all this sort of stuff. And, you know, at that time I was 8 years old, and I, again, had two older brothers, so they're 2 years older than me, and I have my twin sister. And what he would do is he would give us Benadryl. And my father was a Parvis Davis salesman, and he gave us Benadryl, and he gave us too much. So we fell asleep, and he loved that sound. He loved quiet. And so we go up there, but he gave us too much, and we all started throwing up. And I distinctly remember at that point that I love that buzz. I want more of that buzz. How do you get more of that buzz? 8 years old, I had that thought. My brothers were throwing up. I was throwing up. But gosh, that, you know, it's only throw up. I mean, what the hell? It's just, and you're done. It was not that big of a deal to me. But from that point on, I wanted to go get Dad bears. I wanted to go get everyone bears. And my grandfather, on my mom's side, he was a big shot there in Fresno. He owned a dealership, and he owned some of West Side properties, some Fig Garden Village. We knew everyone, Al Radke, all these great big people. I had a great uncle, his name was Sandy. He, I guess, was in the King of California, and he sold out to Boswell for $16 million. That doesn't mean anything to me, though, because they taught me how to drink. They taught me how to drink, and here's how my grandfather taught me. We were discussing one time some of my favorite characters in history, and my parents had gone to Japan it was a sister city, and so they went through the Chamber of Commerce, and my grandfather said, who's your favorite political person? I said, Winston Churchill. He said, he is a functioning alcoholic, and I will teach you how to be one. And he did. At 12, I was doing shots with him, brandy shots. And the great thing about that is they were beautiful glasses. Now, my father being that educated, he bought a ranch. So my story is about not only like the, I guess, country club set, but it was also, I was out in the fields a lot because that ranch was 40 acres and we just worked continually. My father was a great one for just continual work all the time. I mean, vacations were work. Everything we did was work. It's just, Jesus, God. It just went on and on. But here's what happened. But I've got to stop. Here's the great thing. My father did the best he could. I was defiant. I didn't learn hardly anything. So what he did is he bought this ranch in 1954 at Bear Ground. He developed it. And I'm out there. And I'm with the pickers, and gosh, they're great. I love them. I mean, they cussed at me a lot, and they, you know, called me all kinds of names that, you know, I later understood, but at that time I did not. Oh, man, one of the greatest things, I went up to Dad once. I was about 12 or 13 years old, and I said, Dad, man, they keep calling me names. And he goes, so what? I go, what do I do? He says, work harder than them. So that's what I started to do, and I earned their respect. And then they showed me how to hide booze and drugs and all that. What they did was, it's hot out there, man. It's 110 degrees. There's no wind. There's nothing. So, I mean, you could drink warm tequila, and that's really not bad once you get over the warm tequila flavor, but the thing is that they would hide it under the drip line, so they would bury things. And they buried things for me quite often. Then I learned how to do it. So I could functionally work very hard. But here's the thing. It smells. Alcohol smells. And I saw what they did. So they took a rotten orange or a semi-rotten orange off a tree, and then they would eat some of it. And the flavor and the smell of that would just kind of hide everything. So I thought. So that's how we would do it. Now, my father being a pharmaceutical salesman, that is just fun, I thought back then. He would keep things in a wooden cabinet, but the wooden cabinet had hinges that you could take off. Not hinges, little screws, and he would lock it like it would be safe. Don't go in, Rollin. You know, that's what I was. So it's the middle of the night, and I could get in there, and the great thing is they had Benadryl, but in the 60s and the 70s, it was done in, it was really, I mean, incredible stuff. But what he had, what I liked, was little pill vials. You could put pills in. And the great thing about those had no child protective. You could just pop them. So, you know, it was going on like this, and I thought I was hiding things pretty well. In fact, I was getting, but being the number three son, you're thought of as, well, not quite all there. So anything I said, I really felt anything I said, anything I did, was completely out of place. School, even though my mom was a teacher for a couple years for me, I didn't do well in school because I wasn't focused on school. I didn't care about school. And so it goes along, and at 16 years old, my mom was a, and to me, in my heart, she's a beautiful lady, and she was having affairs with other men around town. And Visalia, during that time, everyone knew everything. I mean, I swear, it was 30,000 people, believe me. And when I found out about that, I was so mad. Oh my God, was I mad. And I found those letters when I was 16 years old. And it was my neighbor right across the street. And I said, well, God, I am. I confronted it with that. And that, again, that's when the incomprehensible things my mom did to me. And it shattered me. It made me angry. It made me extremely angry. And so now, I'm using with a purpose. There's nothing more incomprehensible, and what the steps have done is that kind of freed me of that fear and guilt. But my mom and I kind of went into a silent war for a lot of years, and I would steal from her and she would steal from my stash. But the thing is, mom would do stashes in dressers and in drawers. I would bury it. See, I didn't really sleep that much. I would read a lot. One of the things was Treasure Island is one of my favorite books. And what that is about is a bunch of drunks trying to find buried treasure. And I thought that was just a great idea. So I watched my mom. I started to watch my mom very carefully, how she hid things, how she did things. Now, I didn't think this is abnormal. What is abnormal about this? This is my family. We have educated people in a middle class, upper middle class, well respected, all this sort of stuff, and we were absolutely out of our minds. Father, workaholic, enables my mom. Mom, an alcoholic, beautiful woman having affairs, and I would track them down. I would see it in the parking lot right in front of me. Oh my God, the things I said. Oh, the things I said. And it was alcoholism for my mom. It was alcoholism, but I didn't know that back then. I didn't know any of that back then, and she broke me. Well, that night she did break me, and I'm told, was put in an institution for a couple days that my father never told me about until I was 51 years old. I have absolutely no memory of it. I do remember, I do remember the yellow pills, and those were good, I guess. And I would forget this town. Anywhere I saw my mother, I would forget the place that I saw her, because I knew what she was doing. And come to find out, she learned that, again, you can't give what you don't have, but you can give what you do. She learned that from my grandfather. Now, I've got to stop right here and say where I was at spiritually. Spiritually, I had nothing inside me. There was absolutely nothing. All I wanted to do was get high. But I didn't want to get high and pay the cost of getting high. I don't know if that's called functional or just stupid. I think it's both, functionally stupid. So what I started to do during high school, before high school, this is where these little pill things come in. You can mix a clear alcohol, and you could, at that time, you could get alcohol anywhere around here. I mean, it was almost as plentiful as oranges on a ranch. It was everywhere. So what you could do, what I did, was I got alcohol, I put it in these little vials, and then I put Benadryl on top, and so I would go to school, and before, if something really bad happened, and usually did, some sort of fight breakout, something happens, some sort of debate, I would do one of those vials. Oh, it's tremendous. The freedom I felt. Oh, such an ease. There's no pain. There's pain, but it's not noticeable pain. That's a big difference for me. I was in pain. I didn't notice it. I didn't know how to deal with that. Now, Christianity to me at that time didn't make any sense. Because, you know, there's a little thing called the Ten Commandments. I think one of them says, thou shalt not commit it. Well, how do you reconcile with that? I don't know. Back then, I don't know. Now, I really think I can begin to know. So God to me at that time was the type of God that you had to... See, you had to memorize the scriptures. If you could memorize more scriptures than the other person, well, then I think you were more godlier. And then I think back at that time, if you wore a tie a certain way, said certain things at certain times, kind of had the whole vibe down, the culture of the church down, well, then you would be considered a righteous Christian. Wow, man, I went to drunk church. I fell down the steps, and my dad just told me, he would grab me, and he would say, well, you know, he's really tired. You know, how's that for incomprehensible? My father was demoralizing. He didn't know what to do with me. So what he did is what was given to him. He gave me workbook after self-help book after self-help book after self. One of them, the last one I did, I was 21 years old. God, he goes, man, Roland. He goes, you need to know how to set goals. So, you know, this is a 45-page book in which you have to do diagrams and essays and all this sort of stuff. And I go, sure, Dad. I mean, you know, I'm kind of used to all this by now. And so I did it, and he felt better about it. And prior to that, I went to 3 years of COS, 3 years of the best times of my life. And the thing is, he wanted me to go to welding school because he felt if I was a certified welder, I could eat. And gosh, man, the people in that welding class at that time knew how to smoke pot, knew how to do a lot of things. Now, I didn't smoke pot because, well, it's just illegal. But in a welding class, you really can't smell it amongst all the other things. And so some of those guys, we would go out and, of course, drink and do all that sort of thing at Mooney's Grove, or, you know, if we passed a particular test, there was always a good reason to party. But here's the point. My father was extremely, extremely concerned about me, and he didn't know what to do. And he had... he tried this also. He sent me to Johnson O'Connor, and that was an aptitude test. And what I did was I would take a series of tests, and I flunked all of them, and I didn't have any talent. And we're on the way home, and I know he's disappointed because it's that kind of hard silence. Love that kind of silence. It's just, how you doing, Dad? Well, Dad, here, I think I'd be a good policeman. It looks like the aptitude says that, you know, I can, you know, see things in a room. He goes, no. He goes, you get spit on. And I go, well, I got brothers that do that already. I'm pretty good with that. But he didn't know what to do, and I didn't know what to do. I didn't know I was sick. So college was, I don't remember. That's what college was. I mean, you know, I look back on it, and the term functioning alcoholic, or, you know, a high bottom, a low bottom, I don't understand any of that. But what I did know was I was away from the family for the first time, and I was away from that continual work habit, just work, 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 work. And the amazing thing, other people thought that we were affluent. That we had, you know, we had a great little big house, 3,000 square. Dad never turned on the air conditioner. So we slept in the house. So there was a lot of things that, I guess, looked like affluency, but wasn't. It was total chaos a lot of the time, and we didn't know it. We just lived that. So when I went to college, I was free. And I got a nighttime janitor job, $500 a month. I could eat, because then I would wake up, I would do the Saturday night parties, that was tremendous, and then you'd wake up and they'd feed you, the senior citizens would feed Sunday. And I managed to keep that going because you'd be a couple weeks on and then a couple weeks off. $500. God, man, in 1983, that is spelled freedom. So I got this truck, it's a 1979 Datsun that I called Thor. And I thought, God, I'm, you know, Jesus, I'm free. I'm going somewhere. So I went to a place called Seattle. Now, you know, I finally got there. I probably hit Oregon a little bit, Oregon City. I remember that place. So I got to Seattle and I parked in this place. And I had, about 100, 150 maybe. And I'm going, man, that's good for a couple days. And I don't remember. See, I don't remember. I do remember coming to, and I'm bruised up, but I don't remember. Wow. I can't believe it. So the great thing is, this is before cell phones, any of that sort of stuff. So I just kind of wobbled back home and started into school. Now, prior to that, I got to tell you, we went to this big convention, and it was a Model United Nations, and I'm kind of backtracking. It's the first time my dad and mom let me travel, and it was in New York City. God, I love it. It was the National Model United Nations. Now, you go into the General Assembly, it's a big kind of wide thing, about 3 to 4 times wider than this, but there's all these smart people there, and I didn't think I was one of them. So the great thing is, I'm the country Iceland. First of all, I don't know how we qualified to go to the Nationals, but the second thing is, I'm supposed to talk. Oh, Jesus. Okay, so there's this guy that had an H on his jacket. I hate that jacket. It was kind of a blue blazer, I know a lot of words, kind of blazer. And it had an H on his jacket, and I looked at him, and he goes, hey, what country are you? And I said a lot of cuss words. I said, I'm from the country of, you know, F. You know what I'm saying? And what country are you? And I go, and then I said, I'm from Iceland. And he goes, well, what's that country do? I go, bricks and things like that. The point is, I was extremely insulting to this guy. And what I thought was happening was there was this private school down called Smith College, and only girls could go to that. Girls, and you know, I was 21. I go, yep, I got this, girls. What an ass I was. What a complete ass. My God, I insulted this guy. dropping the F-bombs left and right. It's not I'm against the F-bombs. I love them. They can be used as pronouns, proper nouns, anything like that. But in my sobriety, I just find that kind of language feeding into something that I don't like that's inside me. I just don't like that. Now, I don't care if you say it, who says it. It doesn't bother me a bit. But I don't know how that came about. And I don't really try to time that kind of stuff anymore. It's just all of a sudden my higher power says, oh, it's not like a voice. God, wouldn't that be great? But it's not. It's just a, ugh, do you really need to talk like that? Yeah, I do. And so what I found in these little things, what was going on was I was holding treasures from the past. Treasures. Big time treasures of things that I did, of the fighting I did. Gosh, in the 70s it was great growing up here again because you could fight. Oh my God, you could fight. And no one's going to call anyone. Go out there in the fields, someone insults you, you insult them, you get in a fight, you get drunk, you get in a fight again. Hopefully you could get drunk again and then get in a fight. That happens so frequently. It's such a lifestyle. Well, how I finally sobered up was my father had passed away, and I was divorced by this time, and I just started to drink. I don't know why. I just thought that was a good thing to do. You know, gin and candy bars is a great combination. The crunchiness and textures of the candy bars and the soothing numbness from drinking. And I would drink and I would drink and I drank. And I remember coming to, rolling over, didn't know I was in a bed, started throwing up, face down, having my bottle knocked over, not being able to get my bottle. But I sobered up and I went to my psychologist at the time. Well, he still is, but I went to him. And he asked me to talk about my drinking. He goes, do you shake when you wake up? And I go, well, doesn't everyone shake when they wake up? And so what happened was, he said, you're an alcoholic. And my mom was going through it at that time. She had 6 months to live at that time, and I didn't know it. But I had the realization that that was going to happen. Step one, gosh, I admitted it. And so how do you get to a meeting? So he showed me on his phone how he got to a meeting, and well, not he, but how I should. And that just kind of totally blew me away. I started crying and started sobbing uncontrollably. And that's a good place to do it, if you're going to do it. I mean, but man, I had to pull myself together, get home, and I called someone who told me that they would look it up. But I just didn't have much time. I felt my time for help was coming really close to an end. So I finally found out, and I went to a Rule 62 meeting, and went in there, and I was so ashamed. My mother is an alcoholic. My grandfather is an alcoholic. And then I have to stand up and admit that I'm an alcoholic. Because that's what we do in these rooms. We just have to admit that. Holy, are you serious? I mean, come on. I have to admit it. Admit that I'm powerless. That's exactly what I have to admit that I'm powerless. And the great thing about being raised the way I raised, there is no such thing as powerless, because there's a thing called lists. You make plans. You go to plan A, plan B, plan C. And if those don't work, you go ahead and make another plan. And it didn't work anymore. I didn't have any plans. My one big plan is just to check out. God, please, let me check out. But going to that meeting, going to Rule 62, having a couple people greet me, and I didn't know them, but my sponsor comes up, and he goes, oh, hello, how are you there? You're in the group of winners. And it just blew me away that I would be greeted. That's the only thing I remember out of that whole meeting. I'm sure they read chapter 5, chapter 3, did some shares, but I didn't understand a thing they said. Then I went to another meeting. And the next meeting I remember going to was at the Monday night at the PBAV, men's stag meeting. And they were talking about the word of responsibility, and I just couldn't get my head around it. Now, I got this big book. They call it Alcoholics Anonymous, and it had a bunch of pages in it. So I started to read it, and I couldn't understand what I was reading. Had no idea. But I didn't want to read it. God, I'm tired of reading. I'm tired of academics. I'm tired of having to memorize stuff. I'm sick of it. But there it was again, step one. And then it said the word we, and I didn't understand the word we. I mean, I know what it is, but I don't understand spiritual. So what I did was I got the big book on Audible, and I started playing it over and over again. I started playing it. And one of the things I'm so appreciative about my father is this, is he taught us how to work. I love that. In the big book, they call that trudging. Or you're just going up one road down the next. You don't know, but you just keep going. And the big book is so wonderful that I know about it now because it's a book about you always moving forward. It doesn't matter how long you're on a step. It's just that you're moving forward. That's tremendous. So I had to admit that I was powerless over alcohol. So I stood up and go, I'm Roland. God, man. I bet people know me. I've been in this town my whole life. I mean, I'm sure my mother doesn't have a good reputation, but I know my father has somewhat of a good one. Oh, God, really? My mom's dying. Mom, Roland, I am an alcoholic. I could hardly say it. Guess what happened? You started to clap. I could not believe it. I heard the sounds, and I'm thinking to I'm not thinking. I'm numb. But I am thinking, too, that what is that? They're clapping for admitting that I'm something that I don't want to be. So I got used to that. I got used to going to the meetings. I just kept going to meetings. I kept going to meetings. I didn't understand very much, but I started to read the big book. And then this sentence came in. This came up when I was hearing it. If you put as much effort into your drinking as you do, you can put as much effort as you want into this program. And if you put as much effort into it as you did drinking, there is no doubt you will be successful. There is no doubt that the promises, and there was words to that effect, and that rung true to me. Because I could do that. I knew I could do that. So I started to do that. And I started to read the big book. And I read it as much as I could all the time. And then my sponsor said to me, there's no fear or guilt. Keep it out of the dictionary. So I went to my family dictionary that I had and I crossed it out. But there was something else that he said. If you think about it more than twice, write about it. Oh, gee. No, really, I got to write about it. If I think about it twice, did you know my dad? I mean, that was the kind of assignment he would give. If I think about it. Now, so, you know, I go, think about what? Think about a person that's doing you wrong. Think about something that causes you have to write about it. So that's what I started to do. And now, he didn't ask me to show it to him. He just asked me to write about it. So that's what I did. Day and night. Go to work, come home, I'd write. Go to sleep, wake up, I'd write, I'd read, I'd go. I'd go, and I'd write about all the people that did me things wrong. All of them. I wrote about my mother, my father, my brother. Not my sister, she's great. But I wrote about all those. I wrote about people in the street, people I knew since childhood, people I knew in high school, people I knew in college. I wrote about institutions. Hate them. Anything that caused me discomfort, I wrote about it. Step two. Oh, God, step two. Step two was one of those things that I could make a God of my understanding. I had to surrender. I had to begin to surrender to that. So I did. I made a list. I made 15 things. And part of that list was people that God would show up when I was there. It was a big one for me. That he had to show up. That he loved me no matter what. That he would be kind to me no matter if I messed up. There's 15 separate things. I didn't know that, but what it looked like to me now is that I was trying to control God. Now, my mom died of the disease, and that's a terrible thing. My mom died of the disease of alcoholism, and I saw it. And I was sober 20 days for it. And we exchanged some beautiful things. And she told me she loved me, but not like an alcoholic, like a mother does. And she asked me to do something for her that I couldn't do. And I told her, Mom, I can't do that. She goes, can you give me peace? And I go, I can't do that, Mom. I cannot give you peace. And I can pray for you, though. And so we prayed together. Now, come on. You know, I was talking to my sponsor before I went there. He says, he told me to, you know, you don't need anything to drink over. You're an alcoholic. He was absolutely right. But that happened, and I don't know anything about the big book. And something like that happened, I was so grateful. So I'll go back to my list about God and all this sort of stuff. And what it started to turn into is the person that I wanted to be. That list is the person that I wanted to be. I didn't know that. But step three, I've got to abandon. Abandon. I had to abandon. Leave. Not leave and pretend it's not there, but just leave it. And so my sponsor said that you have to do one thing. You have to do just one thing in this program, and that's change everything. And I don't know how to do that. I know how to work. I know how to make lists. I know how to make plans. But then I finally recognized that this is a spiritual program. Now, I started beginning to understand that in step two. But step three, when I have to abandon every word that I don't understand with my heart, I need to figure it out. For example, kindness. Open-mindedness. Kindness and open-mindedness. Well, open-mindedness means to me that I have to listen to you and care about what you're saying. Kindness means I have to do something for me. This is what it means to me. I have to do something for you that I can't expect anything back. Don't need anything back. Don't want anything back. And the great thing about my higher power is that I can go to him in the morning and say, God, I need to learn how to be kind. Well, can you help me out? Just, it's that simple for me. And so he did help me out. He gave me this idea that I would go and open doors for people I don't know. And how I did that is I went up and down Main Street. And I would just open the doors. And I went four times, up and back, up and back. And no one said thank you. And that just irritated. I mean, Jesus, who's your mom and dad for that one? But no one said thank you. And you know, the big book says there's anything, you know, if you're feeling discomforted, it's your problem. It was. So I kept doing that. And on the fourth time, someone said thank you, and I wasn't expecting it. I wasn't trying to angle for anything. I was just trying to be kind. Open-mindedness, you can have a different opinion of me, but I still want the best for you. And that was a long journey to kind of start to crack that one a little. But at step three, it says if you crack the door just a little bit, it will flood in. If you're just willing, that's it. Wow, I could do that. All you have to do, for me, I just say it. I'm willing. God, I'm willing. Teach me. I am willing. Because the life I had at 50, from, you know, however old I was, 10, 12, 8 years old, when I first got that, to 55 and a half years old, I had run the course. The next one was dead. And look, what I found out too for me, I never knew no one cared about what I had to say. I could be booked up, smart, I could do all this, and they don't give a damn. No one cared. But they did care about if I treated them with respect and kindness and open mind. They did care about that, and the response is overwhelming. I started to do that without being told. It was wonderful to be kind to people. It's incredible. So in step three, I started to learn how to be kind and to be open-minded and started loving. Now that is a crazy emotion, but on May 22nd, in the Reflections, it says this, and this is the term that really got me. It says to be an instrument of God's healing love. Not the God I grew up with, but God's healing love. I don't know how to do that. Instrument? Is it sharp? You know, is it? How am I going to do that? So what I started to do is ask God how to be that instrument. And most of the time is I don't say anything. And I'll just listen to you. And I don't care what I have to do. I don't care what I have to do in the next 10 minutes. But for right now, I could just listen to you. And that's the only thing I know how to do. Just listen. I can't fix it. I can go off and pray for you without you knowing it. And I guess that's the blessing. It's a tremendous blessing. So the first three steps, my mom left the fourth step. She left on this fourth step because it's a moral inventory. For me, I had to write down everything that I was involved. But when I got there, I started to understand that God loved me. I started to be able to look in the mirror and say, I'm starting to get comfortable with you. I'm not quite there yet. And write what it's like now after 377 days, I can look in the mirror and know without a shadow of a doubt that God loves me. I don't have 15 things that He has to do to prove that to me. He just loves me. The God of my understanding just loves me. And I know He loves my mom. I know He does. And I'm sure He loves my dad. They were divorced. But I'm just sure He loves my dad. I'm sure my father's in some big library up there in the sky, looking out stuff. But to have that realization, they call that in the big book a psychic change. They call that probably a design for living. They call it a lot of different things. But what I call that is sobriety. Healthy, emotional sobriety, where I'm present. And it says in the big book that we will have a new happiness. A new happiness. I don't even know what that... New? Like you go to a car and you get it new. No one scratched it yet, thrown up in it yet, and, you know, messed around. I looked up that term. I wanted to see what it meant spiritually. New means never before seen. I feel that inside. I feel like, for me, this is the person that I've always wanted to be and didn't know it. Because all I want to be is kind and gentle. I don't, you know, whatever belief system you have, if you're happy with it, I'm happy with it. I don't have to debate you on it. I don't have to prove that you're wrong, and I don't have to prove that I'm superior by proving to you that you're wrong. Because of the God of my understanding, and here's the great thing. They said it was a spiritual program. Didn't know that. What's spiritual mean? Well, for me, I didn't know what spiritual meant. You know, I'm always asking, what's that mean? Yeah. Spiritual, for me, means that something that hasn't seen, that you know it's there. And you want to get to know that entity better. And once you just get a little taste of it, just a little taste, you want that more than alcohol. You want that more than Benadryl. Drugs. Want it more. Spiritual is for me is understanding that entity that I can't see or I can't hear worked for me and I didn't even know it. Loves me and He shows it to me by the people in this room. By you sharing. Giving of your time. But the greatest thing, the people outside of this room can start to see a change in me and I don't understand what they're seeing. It's a humbleness without work. Because I know I'm an alcoholic. And I'll always be an alcoholic. And I'm grateful that I am one. Because it gave me a chance to see my mom and understand the disease. And on January 24th, 1986, when she went into the program and right before she went out, she wrote this. She said in her diary, I got her diaries. It was tremendous. She said, I know that God loves me and cares for me. Prior to that, she was making lists and statistics about alcohol, knew a lot about alcohol, knew that it caused death, knew this, knew all these sort of things, complained about the people in the meetings. You know, it's easy to do, is complain about them. She complained about that, but she got it January 24th, 1986, and then she went back out. That must have been torture for her, to know that she was loved and she rejected it, to know that God didn't stop caring for her, but she didn't understand that, and to know that I have a love, and all I have to do is one day at a time, one moment, sometimes one minute. And so if I say something that is wrong, I know how to ask for forgiveness and mean it. I know how to make an amends to the best of my ability, and then I can go to sleep. Because the God of my understanding, He loves me. And I really appreciate you sitting here listening to me. I'm Roland. I'm an alcoholic.